the former host of Loose will be having the mic passed to him, Gerhard. And I think I'll phone him 5 times during the show. It would be only fair and fitting, and I'm sure enjoyable for both of us.
Friday afternoons on CKUW 95.9 FM is brought to you by Half Pints Brewing Company, Winnipeg's only local brewery. Think local, drink local. Half Pints.
Welcome to Warning Shots here on CKUW 95.9 FM. I'm your host, Alex Patterson, and I'm in the studio once again with Elena Lajoie O'Malley. We're bringing to you the last installment in this round of our climate change documentary series.
Indeed, we are. I don't know who we're talking to today. I think we're hearing an interview that Alex pre-recorded with Bill McKibben. Is that right?
That is correct. Bill McKibben is the founder of 350.org and a prolific journalistic writer on issues related to climate change. Before we go into that, we're going to hear a couple tracks. And then the last thing that we're going to do is we're going to have a short interview with Vanessa Gray, an indigenous participant in Power Shift. But without further ado, we are going to jump into the news briefs right away. The slow rate of emissions cuts in major economies has put the world on track for at least 6 degrees of warming by the end of the century, analysts warn today. New research by consultancy giant PwC finds an unprecedented 5.1% annual cut in global emissions per unit of GDP, known as carbon intensity, is needed through to 2050 if the world is to avoid the worst effects of climate change and meet an internationally agreed target of limiting average temperature increases to just 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels. Such deep reductions in carbon intensity would be over 6 times greater than the 0.8% average annual cut achieved since 2000.
One World Asia reports, farmers in Kurukshetra, India, where field trials of Monsanto's GM corn forced the Haryana Agricultural University authorities to fulfill their promise on completely destroying the field trial today. This happened after a day-long drama where Monsanto's officials, with the support of the university staff, tried to sneak out the GM corn from the field trial this morning. Alert villagers stopped them. Hundreds of farmers under the leadership of Gurunam Singh, state president of BKU, surrounded the research station when the news spread that Monsanto was stealthily removing its GM corn from the trial site instead of inside the research station.
Intercontinental Cry reports that indigenous people in southwest Ethiopia have implicated the World Bank in grave human rights abuses that are being carried out as part of the resettlement program headed by the Ethiopian government. The government is currently working to resettle approximately 1.5 million peoples across the country by 2013. Villagization is supposed to be a voluntary process that offers increased access to basic services and improved food security. However, according to the Anak, who reside in the Gambela region, nothing could be further from the truth. The Anuak say they are being dispossessed of their fertile ancestral lands and forced into new villages where there is little access to food or arable land. The Toronto Media Co-op reports the Canadian government has been confidentially briefing major energy companies with classified intelligence, leading groups protesting the tar sands and other energy projects to fear they are being spied on by federal agents for the benefits of private corporations. The briefings are organized by Natural Resource Canada with the collaboration of the Canadian Security Intelligence Service and the RCMP, according to documents acquired by Tim Groves of the Media Co-op through Access to Information legislation. And with that, we are going to jump into a track by Union Made, We Were There, and then Rise Against, Help Is On The Way, while we prepare the first bit of content that we have for you, Bill McKibben of 350.org.
We were there! Hey there, if you're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM and you're into what you're hearing, why don't you give us a call? Our on-air line is 774-6877.
And now to our interview with Bill McKibben.
Years beginning with the first book about climate change back in 1989, a book called The End of Nature. Most recently, a kind of bookend to that, a book called Earth, but spelled wrong, E-A-A-R-T-H.
I guess I just want to know a little bit about your impressions of Rio Plus 20 since you just got back from there.
Rio Plus 20 was, I'm afraid, predictably, a failure, a big one. That's not the surprise. I suppose the poignant part is the plus 20 part. You know, the first Rio conference in 1992 was a scene of great hope, but that hope has pretty much faded at this point. The failure of the international system to do anything about our most pressing problems is not a surprise because the power of the fossil fuel industry has prevented them from doing anything. But it is always a sobering reminder of just what trouble we're in.
What were some of the concrete outcomes that actually came out of Rio? Was there any types of agreements that were being touted as really significant or important?
No. I don't think anyone's making a case that they did really anything of any use. There were some, you know, along the sidelines, some businesses announcing some sustainability initiatives and things. But nothing happened at Rio of any importance.
So what do you see the function of these large climate summits now?
I don't think there really is much function at the moment. You know, the youth who were there asked me to join them in a walkout of the Rio conference on Thursday, and I gladly did because I didn't think I was going to miss anything by not being there. I think the onus on us now is to build movements strong enough to counterbalance the financial power of the fossil fuel industry. And if we can do that, if we can at all put them on the run, then maybe in the future they'll be willing to actually negotiate. But at the moment they hold all the cards, and so there's really no point in doing this kind of thing.
I'm definitely on point with you there, but before we go on that tangent, which I think is the most interesting part, I think we do need to spend some time a bit more dissecting some of the things that are being proposed to us, because especially here in Canada, even many prominent progressive voices, such as the New Democratic Party, who acknowledge the climate crisis and acknowledge the climate science that points towards what's happening, are still promoting solutions like cap and trade. And I'm wondering what you think of solutions like cap and trade.
Well, I think that there's no question that the key thing we've got to do is put a really serious price on carbon, one that reflects the damage it does in the atmosphere. I think the simplest way to do that, and probably the only really politically useful one, is what people now are calling fee and dividend. Put a hefty price on carbon, collect the tax, and rebate the money straight to consumers. If anyone owns the sky, you know, it's us, not Exxon.
I guess I'm wondering what hefty would be then.
Hefty enough to keep in the ground most of the fossil fuel reserves of the coal and gas and oil industry, because if they burn even a fraction of what they've announced that they're planning to burn, every scientific analysis shows it'll take us way past even inadequate targets like 2 degrees.
Yeah, when I was going through your book for a second time, it's been a while since I read it the first time, you were saying that even coming out of Copenhagen, we were on pace for a range of between 725 to 600 parts per million CO2 equivalent gases in the atmosphere. And I'm wondering what type of world does that look like?
nothing like any human being has ever even begun to see. We just went past 400 parts per million in the Arctic this winter, and it'll be globally a past 400 parts per million within a year or so. That's the highest CO2 concentrations we've had in at least 800,000 years, probably far longer than that. We already see at that level, with about 1 degree increase in temperature, we see 40% of the sea ice in the Arctic gone. We see the ocean about 30% more acid, and we see, since warm air holds more water vapor than cold, we see about a 4% increase in the average moisture in the atmosphere, which is a staggering increase, and one that loads the dice for both drought and flood. Already the planet's being whipsawed by these kind of changes. That's at 1 degree. The kind of world that the fossil fuel industry envisions will be 4 or 5 degrees warmer, and it'll be a science fiction landscape. Never had a plan that got us anywhere near where we need to go. I mean, the hope at Kyoto was that it would be a first step immediately and quickly followed by other steps, but as it turned out, the fossil fuel industry was able to mostly kill off Kyoto to keep it from ever getting approved in the U.S., and hence no one else took it very seriously, and we never really got anywhere. Well, I think that what we got to do is, as I said before, build movements. You know, that's what we've been working on at 350.org for the last 4 years, and we've begun to have some success. We've organized about 20,000 demonstrations in every country on Earth except North Korea, and really spread awareness of the problem. And in recent year or so, we've begun to be a little more confrontational. In the U.S., we spearheaded the drive to stop the Keystone XL pipeline. We've had some temporary success with that. Environmentalists usually only win temporary victories, and this one may be more temporary than most, since the fossil fuel industry and its subsidiary, the Canadian government, has been bringing all the pressure they can on Washington to approve their thing, and they may get it approved. But at least we've begun to show that we can stand up to these guys. Now we just have to do it in a much bigger way.
What do you see as the trajectory of where the movement needs to go, and what do you see as the type of actions that are really going to force world leaders taking the steps that we really need them to?
I'm less worried at the moment about forcing world leaders than about changing the perspective of the fossil fuel industry. And the only thing that'll do that is to cause them some financial pain and uncertainty. I hope that we're able to spark, among other things, a kind of divestment movement around the world that looks a little bit like the one that helped get businesses out of South Africa a generation ago. This is obviously a harder and bigger problem, but it's a moral problem in exactly the same way. If we can get people to understand the moral problem here, the fact that the business model of the fossil fuel industry is in direct opposition to the health of the planet, then we've got a chance.
I've heard a lot of people starting who are really up to date and current with their understanding of where climate change is at, saying that it's essentially, and this actually comes from a lot of indigenous people, a lot, they've been saying it for a long time, that it's almost a spiritual or cultural crisis that we're at, that the very root of the problem is a struggle for decolonization of our minds and our relationship with the environment. Where do you come down on that?
I think that's probably largely true, and I think that we don't have the time. Physics and chemistry doesn't give us the time for a sort of thoroughgoing re-education of everybody, where we sort of learn a certain amount of humility, and then I think we're going to have to do it on the fly. One of the ways to accomplish that happily is to put that same hefty price on carbon. That'll have the effect, I think, of making us build more localized economies, bring us somewhat more closely in touch with the world around us, do some of those things that need doing. The thing that makes me wonder whether we'll be able to do it in time is simply that we have to do it in very short order. Physics and chemistry don't bargain. They won't wait for us to kind of get our act together. And the amount of time, the kind of window they're giving us to operate is shorter than, short enough that it's an open bet whether we'll actually make it or not.
Yeah, I was listening to David Suzuki quote someone yesterday on Democracy Now, and it was something like a 50-50 shot that we'll make it to, like, 2150.
Well, I mean, it depends, I guess, what we mean on we'll make it. I mean, the planet will be here, obviously, and there'll be people here. The question is whether we're going to have the kind of conditions that have allowed civilizations like the ones we know to continue flourishing or not. And I'm afraid that is a very open question.
If you could quantify it, how long do you think we have before we can salvage what we hold most dear, I guess?
Well, all one can say with any certainty is that we get deeper in the hole each day. And, you look around a day like today, we've got a tropical storm raging in the Gulf of Mexico, the first time ever we've gotten to our fourth named storm of the year before July. We've got the worst wildfires ever recorded in Colorado and New Mexico burning out of control. We've got, just go on down the list. We've got around the world 1,000 signs already of the trouble we're in, and lots of people for whom action already will have come too late. So it's not getting any better day by day.
I guess one of the big questions for me and where I'm at, because I do door-to-door canvassing for an environmental group, and that's kind of where I get to get a picture of what people are thinking and feeling in the, like, day-to-day neighborhoods.
Yeah, that's really interesting. What do you find?
I find that the people that are most open to talk about it are often some of the people that would most disagree with us. Like, I end up having the best conversations with minors, but the thing that I'm finding is that there's a certain amount of people, and often in those resource industries, who are of the, like, I think our doomsday messaging has gotten so effective mm-hmm. that it's allowing them to cop out.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And that they feel like they'll be in the dirt before they have to deal with the consequences of their actions.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how to trigger activism once they reach that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good question. We spend a lot of time at 350 just being very realistic about things, trying neither to be sort of gloom and doom nor its opposite, Pollyanna-ish. We just sort of devoted to telling the truth, and we've actually found that, lots of people are responding, but clearly not everyone, not most people, really. There are people who are moved by some of the possibilities that are emerging, and you see them in places around the globe. Last month, Germany, on a Saturday, managed to generate half the electricity that the whole country used from solar panels within its borders. You look at something like that and you realize that it's no longer technical trouble that's holding us back. It's political will. And so we got to figure out how to pull it together.
I guess another question that comes out is more directed to thinking about activists who have been in the game for a long time. And it's, where do you find the hope, faith, will, or drive to keep going when it looks like you're up against the wall almost every day and reaching people?
I suppose that's a good question, and it's been a quarter century that I've been working on this issue, and sometimes one gets very despairing. I get to work mostly with young people, but with people all over the globe, and as long as they're willing to do this good work, especially in places where, they haven't even caused the problem, and yet they're willing to work with us and do what they can, as long as that's true, then I'm willing to fighting. And there are days when, sometimes it's just like, if nothing else, at least we can make it a little harder for the bad guys.
Yeah, it's kind of a funny thing. Like, I've been seeing some of, like, the people who are, like, most in the know of the activists, people that I know here, that they're almost, like, operating in this zone where they put aside their personal feelings of, like, doom and gloom, and they sometimes it almost feels like they're going through the motions, and then they go home to a far more despairing existence because of, like, I think we inundate ourselves so much with the drastic pictures.
I kind of find that as long as I'm doing all that I can, then despair doesn't become as much of a problem. Just like, okay, we're doing what we can do.
Yeah. And I guess another thing that I guess Suzuki brought up the other day on Democracy Now! Was that he imagines setting up a Bretton Woods 2 conference to remake the whole global system and prioritize earth, air, and water. So it started making me wonder what types of institutions that are missing or need to be drastically reformed that you see we need to focus on building to create a more resilient and actually sustainable human world in, like, the local or regional or international context. What types of institutions are you looking to see built?
Well, I think that if we can make the big global step of getting off carbon, of putting a serious price on carbon, then we'll see millions of new kinds of institutions built at small local levels the world over. That the world will become somewhat less globalized, at least in its economic life, and somewhat more localized, and that this will result in every kind of different institution depending on where you are. One of the insights of ecology, of course, is that we don't want to do the same thing every place. Different things make sense in different places. But I'm heartened to see, for instance, the rise of the local food movement. I think it's a good sign we're going in the right direction.
Moving back to the question of how to run a divestment campaign, how do you imagine going about this divestment campaign? Like, what's your first step in the campaign to create this type of divestment movement?
People are going to have to watch a little bit. We're gonna, at 350.org in the months ahead. I think we're going to pretty much launch a big campaign the night after the American elections. And I think we're going to do it then because we want to make the point that no matter who wins, it doesn't going to solve our problems or make them insoluble. No matter who wins, the real problem remains the fossil fuel industry, and that's who we'll go after. And there's no way to do it short but going to campus and town to town, organizing, and we are figuring out lots of ways to do that.
I guess a big question for Canadians, especially here on the prairies in the west of Canada, is I'm wondering what you have to say to us specifically about our tar sands and our coal
You guys are going to have to make some decisions, you know. Canada, which is used to playing a kind of constructive role in the world, is becoming a rogue nation. You guys had to get rid of your Kyoto commitments, because you're at the moment more interested in making money off the tar sands. If you burn those tar sands, you'll run just from the tar sands alone. If you burn the economically recoverable oil there, you'd run the atmospheric concentration of CO2 from 400 parts per million to about 540 parts per million. Jim Hansen at NASA, our foremost climatologist, has said that if we burn them heavily on top of everything else we're already burning, it'll be game over for the climate. Now, there's lots of other things we have to stop burning, too, but the tar sands are clearly high on the list. So you guys got to decide whether you want to, what role in the future of the world you want to play. And at the moment, the Harper government is not only playing a dangerous role for the future in terms of physics and chemistry, they're also, in order to prevent any opposition to that, I think playing a dangerous game with Canadian democracy. The new bill that ends most independent environmental review and things is a bad sign. It's the kind of thing that happens when you let greed be the number one driving force.
It's become a really different game since Harper got his majority up here. There was a very quick shift in the last year of basically the environmentalists here are being essentially branded enemies of the state and radicals. And I mean, like, these are some of like the most liberal environmental organizations you can think of, like Sierra Club and stuff like that, are being branded basically enemies of the state by the Harper government. It's a really weird climate that's developed in the last year.
Yeah, no, it's very odd to watch from down below, especially since, you know, there are so many of us who are so so fond of Canada. I spent my boyhood in Toronto. In fact, I went to the same elementary school, Northlea Public School, at the same time as Stephen Harper. So I you know, I'm not very convinced when he talks about foreign extremists who are causing problems and things. I guess I'm the closest thing to a foreign extremist since I led the fight against the Keystone Pipeline, along with our indigenous brothers and sisters up there. But it's a bad sign when you begin to want to close yourself off from the rest of the world so that no one can see what you're doing. I hope people will join in at 350.org. We work in, as I said, every country in the world save North Korea, and Canada's a big part of that. There's so many Canadians who are so engaged in trying to do the right thing, and it's beautiful to see. And I know that it's tough in some parts of Canada. These opinions and things are unpopular. That doesn't make them any less true, and so many thanks to the courage of people who are carrying this fight.
So that was Bill McKibben from 350.org speaking back in July. And they have launched the newest portion of the 350.org campaign after the election. And tomorrow in India is a 350.org subcontinental-wide action against the coal industry in India. So watch out and look for reports of that. And now we're going to jump into an interview with Vanessa Gray, a member of Amidjuanong First Nation. I'm sorry, I can't speak Eastern dialect. I know my Western dialect a bit better. And Vanessa, are you on the line?
Yep.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi.
I'm Alana.
Hi.
Good to meet you.
Thanks
for joining us today.
No problem.
So I guess I wanted to start out with a question. I know you were you went to PowerShift recently, and I know there's a lot of people here in Winnipeg. There was a small Winnipeg contingent that went, but a lot of us kind of sitting here living vicariously through the people that we know got to be there. And I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about what PowerShift was all about and what you were doing there.
I was there to bring a group of youth from my community. I felt that in my community especially, we needed some more youth leaders, and I just felt that PowerShift was a good choice to take the young people to empower them and let them know that there are others fighting the same battle, and we're not alone.
What kind of battle is it that you're fighting in your community?
Environmental racism.
Wow, that's a term that a lot of people aren't necessarily familiar with. Can you say a little bit about what that means for you and what your experience is with environmental racism?
Well, our reservation is in the Sarnia, Ontario area, where we have 63 high-emitting facilities and within the 50-kilometer radius of our reservation. So what that means is we suffer a lot of the health concerns that we all seem to deal with, such as respiratory issues and more bigger issues like cancer and birth defects and mixed birth ratios, too. There are more girls and boys being born in our community.
What types of facilities and what companies are participating in around your community?
We have a lot of like chemical industries, like oil refining industries. Shell, Enbridge, Petro Canada.
And what kind of sort of environmental impacts are you seeing in your community? So you've said a little bit about what's happening in terms of health, but what are the environmental problems that are sort of being linked with all of these health problems that your community is facing?
Well, the refineries have a lot of releases, and the air is just unhealthy to live in. Our water in the community is toxic now. It's safest not to be in it, in our ponds and creeks and soil and that sort of thing.
And so you were at PowerShift sort of wanting to share this story, I assume, with other members or other people who had were there to attend the conference, or who else were you speaking to?
I'm speaking to everyone in general who aren't aware of the situation and who aren't doing anything about it.
And who is with you? Who are you working with?
I work with a group from Toronto, a group of really awesome activists. I work with a group here in Sarnia, a much smaller group who help me out in any way possible, getting the information we need, always updating our information. And that's pretty much it. It's a small group.
How did you get involved in this kind of work?
I started working with environmental awareness when I was in high school. When I was about 16, I started handing out fact sheets and wanting the information about global warming out there. And then once I was a little older, I started working with youth and broadening their knowledge on environmental issues in our area. I started a youth environmental group called Green Teens, where we sort of just did fun activities, but also gave them the knowledge that they didn't have before. We planted trees, did garbage cleanups, had community events. We did a lot of art projects, including photography is a big one we did, just to show the world our community and what we live in, like day-to-day lives, which looks really weird to a lot of people because not a lot of people live right next to refineries and that sort of thing.
And so this is work that you, I guess, started doing a number of years ago, and probably now you're finding that you're now sort of mentoring newer, sort of younger people starting to get involved. Can you say a little bit about what that's like, sort of going from you know, being 16 and getting started with this kind of thing, and now trying to support other people in doing the same kind of thing?
I feel like now that I'm 20, I feel like I'm getting more knowledge. It never stops, and never stop learning about more sort of depressing issues that go on in my community. I recently went to the third annual Healing Walk in Alberta in August, and so that's really making me learn a lot more about like the bigger issue here, which is the Alberta tar sands, and seeing how that affects their communities there.
And how are you connecting now with young people from other parts of the country?
I do what I can. I speak and I try to give the advice that I can. I want to make youth feel less discouraged like they do from society pushing them down and making them feel like they're nothing, and I just want them to feel like they have a voice and they should use it.
Can you think of one of the most a moment where you felt like you really managed to do something that worked, something that you feel was a real success story that you can share with us?
I guess PowerShift is probably the most successful because It did make the youth realize that they're part of something big, and they felt sort of pushed to do something more in our community, like others are doing in their communities. So since Power Shift, I've been meeting with the same group that I brought out, and we are coming up with plans for like future events and more awareness, like plans, and it's looking pretty good now. At first, I kind of felt like I was working very alone, but all these youth feel the same now, and it pushes them to want to do more.
Yeah, that's totally my experience too. When I was in university and in high school, all of these kinds of conferences and events, they have kind of this multiplying effect, don't they, where you end up being so encouraged by other people and being inspired by other people that it sort of helps you when you start getting kind of frustrated and like there's nothing that's really working.
Yes, yeah.
Is the school in your community involved at all, or are students being able to get involved with this work while they're at school, or is it the kind of thing that they're having to do after they leave home, or they leave for home at the end of the day?
For now, it's going to be after school, just because it's kind of tricky getting into the education system without being like a full-time worker there, or like for myself anyway, like I'm sure the youth could totally start up something within the school, which would be awesome, but that's out of my control. I do what I can.
How important do you feel it is for you, or to you, that you're coming from a community that's based on a reserve? Does that really inform the kind of work you're doing?
Can you rephrase that question? I just don't know what you mean.
Well, I guess I'm curious whether you kind of come at what you're doing really thinking a lot about the fact that you're an Indigenous woman, or that you're a member of a First Nation. And is that important to what you see your role in as being an activist?
Yeah, I think it's super important. I have a lot to say that people need to hear. I guess the role of being Indigenous and a woman and growing up in Chemical Valley really makes myself a sort of knowledgeable in what the rest of the world doesn't know, I guess. I like to think of it as maybe the government wants to keep our town and what our issues sort of a secret. They don't want us getting out, but I feel like speaking out is like so important and so powerful.
What is the main message you would want to say to Canadians who don't know about the effects of the fossil fuel industry on your community? What would be the main thrust of what you want to say?
I want to say, no matter how much you think it doesn't affect you, it really does. like, research what, as much as you can, gain the knowledge that will make you more aware of what's happening in your own country and what's going to happen, and what you could do to prevent these things from getting any worse.
Thank you so much for coming on the show today, Vanessa. And we're encouraging all of our listeners to check out the Power Shift website and keep abreast of what's going to be happening with Power Shift. What was like the next step that people were talking about coming out of Power Shift?
Is that for me?
Yep.
Okay. the next step is to come together with the people who you have met from Power Shift, or take advantage of those contacts that, and those friends you've made, and work together toward change.
So with that said, this is not the last power shift that's going to happen, right?
I'm sorry, hold on. Hi, sorry.
So is there going to be another power shift next year, or?
I am not aware of that. I didn't do much organizing other than the fact I got a couple of yous from my community. I really wish there would be, because it's important to get the knowledge to the younger people as soon as possible so they are aware of what's happening.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, and we will hopefully talk to you soon and hear about amazing projects that you and the youth in your community are coming up with to fight those that are making your home a chemical valley.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Yep. Bye.
Thank you.
So with that, we are going to slip into a track by Sweatshop Union called Dirty Work.
I'd like to see the likes of me relax with the wife and see time to write and read. No fight to get a bite to eat. It might just be a pipe dream, but fuck the alternative. Living a life of greed disconnected from the earth is just obvious to me that the way that we do it's wrong. And I'm not just gonna be the type who prays and moves along, because these days we lose are gone and we need every moment. Man, the maze is too long to proceed that slow. And if the pain stops, I'll crawl up out of bed. But these raindrops keep falling on my head and my brain start recalling what I read back in school, cause I train not to swallow what I'm fed. So for the time being, I'm seeing things a little differently, bringing out the kid in me to sing and shout a symphony and think about the shit that we confuse and take for granted, cause we're losing sacred land as we abuse and rape this planet. And we
get our hands dirty working for the things we need. Spit scraps to eat in the air that I breathe. Need a rest alone and rest time at home. A congested mess and those obsessed with what they own. Get our hands dirty working for the things we need. Spit scraps to eat in the air that I breathe. Need a rest alone. Best time at home, a congested mess. Says what they own. As a free thinking man, I'm proud of who I am. You're deep in sinking sand and not allowed to give a damn. And with this vivid plan, I'll visit lands. I'm sick of name brands, made cynics out of fans, and limit what we understand. Live in this village of the dam, seem a long ways away. Another day gone astray, one more song that gets no play. The old say it's the youth, while the youth say it's the old. The truth is rarely told, unaware we're out of control. Try to hold myself together, but all of it tempts me. A heart and a soul, leather wallet running empty. From MTV to the pages of the source, we pay homage to the hordes who line the shelves of record stores. What's it all for? I often ask myself, should I get off my ass and be like everybody else? Maybe seek some help, or live in rhythm of hell. For an instance, find wealth, but no resistance is felt. Working for the things we need. Spit scraps to eat in the air that I breathe. Need a rest alone and best time at home. A congested mess and those obsessed with what they own. Get our hands dirty working for the things we need. Spit scraps to eat in the air that I breathe. Need a rest alone and best time at home. A congested mess and those obsessed with what they own.
Well, I see barstool prophets and philosopher kings. I hear manic street preachers speak of God and our sins. We gotta begin to see that God is within the you and I verse to earth as it constantly spins. Do you wish to be free or be habitually sleeping? Are we history sheep or will we live to see freedom? Cause we've been lied to all of our lives and I don't think I can take anymore. Fuck TV, high school and all of your lies. I can see right through your face to the core. So don't even try to tell me what to say. I'll make you scream and cry when I take my love away. Day in and day through, I may win, I may lose. And if
all else fails, I may sing and play blues. Hey you, what's your name? Make your hand into a fist. We haven't changed the world, but we can if you resist. Resist, resist, resist.
Dirty working for the things we need. Spit scraps to eat in the air that I breathe. Lead a rest alone and best time at home. A congested mess of those obsessed with what they own. Get our hands dirty working for the things we need. Spit scraps to eat in the air that I breathe. Lead a rest alone and best time at home. A congested mess of those obsessed with what they own.
So that is the last installment of this version of our climate change series. It's been produced by myself with help from Michael Welsh and hosted all along the way with Alana Lajoie O'Malley here.
That's me.
And what are your reflections after these three sets of interviews that we've done?
Well, the thing that's funny is, you know, with the exception of talking to Vanessa, we've been speaking to people that have kind of been working on these issues for a really long time. And there's this really interesting dialogue that I feel like we're having between sort of the veterans and those of us that are maybe a couple decades younger. And I guess that I just hope that when I'm, you know, David Suzuki's age, especially because I think he was especially frustrated when we were talking to him, I hope that I can be less frustrated. You know, I wanna kind of figure out a way to do this work without being so damn sad about it all the time.
Well, with current climate projections, we only have 15 years. So you're either going to be happy in 15 years or you're going to be really, really, really sad. With that said, though, on campus, what are the opportunities for addressing this issue?
Oh, are you inviting me to plug stuff going on in my office now, Alex? Is that what's going on here?
I think this is shameless self-promotion.
Well, before I do that, I also, there's the bike lab. They're starting up the Ice Riders team again this year. And I love the Ice Riders. They're the best. They make me happy. I think they're a really great example of people that are going, hey, let's not just get depressed about all this crap everywhere. Let's kind of do something productive and try and build some positive community. So that's something that I really want to encourage everyone, all of our listeners to.
And I want to encourage all those people to remember that not just positive vibes are going to be able to tear down the corporations that control the fossil fuel industry. So you can bike and have as much fun as you want, but to remember to show up to address these issues in the hard-fought battles that some of the communities like Vanessa's have to fight. It doesn't matter how many bikes they ride. That's not going to take out those fossil fuel industries, nor is it going to stop the Gateway Pipeline from going through. So if you want to be involved in that, there's extra steps beyond the positive and fun things that people need to take. I think it's about time that we jump in to the community cupboard, but Alana's going to plug an event that was in the community cupboard that is from her office before we play the jazzy retro beats.
Boom. So I guess this is when Alex was giving me the opportunity for shameless self-promotion. We're hosting my hero. Well, I don't know her very well personally, but I love what she writes. Her name is Leith Sharp. She started off, I think, as a student activist in Australia back in the 90s, looking at the disconnection between what was happening in her school and what she was learning about around, you know, how institutions should work and how they should run and what they should look like if we're going to deal with our ecological crisis. And you know, now she's become an international, almost an international celebrity among the kind of sustainability nerds of the world. And she's going to be here at the University of Winnipeg on Monday, November 19th. She's going to be offering a public lecture from 12:30 to 1:30 in the atrium of this new science building. And basically, she's going to talk about what's involved in changing big institutions. And it's something that we don't spend enough time thinking about. What does it actually take to change things? So I really encourage people to come and listen to her. I think she's one of the most inspiring speakers I've ever heard. And I don't think people will be disappointed.
All right. And now here are the jazzy beats.
A pen and some paper. It's time for CKW's Community Cupboard. Announcements and resources from and in your community. If you have a public service announcement or community resource to share, contact us at 786-9782 or email ckuw@uwinnipeg.ca.
So the main one that's jumping out at me is something that even I want to learn about, and that is winter composting, a free workshop Tuesday, November 13th, 2012, 7 to 8 p.m. at Daniel McIntyre St. Matthews Community Association, 823 Ellis Avenue, and you can register by calling 204-774-7005. How do we get that stuff to compost in the winter? And it's got a really pretty drawn snowman on the flyer.
I think it's a cute snowman.
It's totally whimsical. And then the last ad that we have for you today for something to do in the community is the 11th Annual Elders and Traditional Teachers Gathering by the University of Manitoba Native Studies Department. It's happening Friday, November 23rd and Saturday, November 24th in the McGeezy Agamic Center, which is 114 Sydney Smith, University of Manitoba, Fort Garry campus. This is a gathering of elders that include Tom Porter from the Mohawk Nation and Florence Painter from the Anishinaabe. There's a pipe ceremony at 7:30 a.m., opening ceremonies at 9 a.m., with welcoming remarks by the president and chancellor. There'll also be a water ceremony, panel discussions, and youth speakers. For more information, call the Aboriginal Student Center at U of M at 474-8850 or check them out on their website. And that is your community cupboard for today. Please stay tuned for Mercy of Slumber. And we're going to end off with Yusuf Islam, Where Do the Children Play?
Fine building jumbo planes, taking a ride into cyberspace. Switch on summer from a slot machine.